first of all, thank you to Jerry and Sandy Bigel sponsoring. Le'ilui Nishmas Alan Feld, I believe his Hebrew name is Avram Shmuel Ben Nachas. Zmirat Hashem, Aaron, who passed away last week. Jason just got up from Shiva technically on Shabbos. Zmirat Hashem, their support of Torah learning and our Torah learning itself should be a Eloi Neshama, an elevation for his soul. And tonight we are certainly talking about a gadol in Torah, because when we think about halacha in the 21st century, as I think I've said before, in terms of judging, you know, people use this analogy for sports, so it'll be Malav Kodesh and use it for something more important than that. When you write down the history of halacha, you can't write it down without the Aruch HaShulchan. When you look back and say, who are the major players, the major codifiers, the major people who made halacha how it's being observed today, you can't say over that history without using the Aruch HaShulchan's name. And that's what we're talking about tonight, the Aruch HaShulchan. More specifically, his name, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein Halevi. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Halevi Epstein, who was born in 1829, his yahrzeit is on the 22nd of Adar. I believe it was a regular Adar, but nonetheless, you know, the second Adar. So it's machlokes as when you observe the yahrzeit. We last month spoke about another Adar yahrzeit, actually the 21st of Adar, of a Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, the namesake of Ritz, if you remember, who was in many ways the Gadol Hador at the time in Russia. And they are basically contemporaries. They didn't die in the same year. Rev Spector was 12 years Rev Epstein's senior, but nonetheless, they did have what to correspond about, and I believe, as I mentioned last week, or last month, Rabbi Epstein actually took over one of the positions of Rabbi Spector, but we'll get to that soon. In 1829, well, first of all, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein's life story actually begins way before that. His great-great-grandfather, one of his great-grandfathers, I don't know how far back, actually was one of those who fled from Spain during the Crusades, not the Crusades, the Spanish Inquisition. And, I mean, that's, you know, the 15th century, so talking a long time ago. But the reason why that's important is because those grandparents that ultimately left Spain first moved to Germany. Welcome, Michael. If you could mute, that would be helpful. You're generally quiet. Once you get situated, you should be okay. But so when they settle in Germany, that family that left Spain, they actually settle in a place called Epstein. I don't know exactly how to pronounce it. I'd assume that in Germany it would be pronounced Epstein, which ultimately became Epstein, especially in America in the 21st century. We call it Epstein. Unfortunately, the name Epstein in secular culture has now become co-opted for unfortunate situations, but we think of Epstein and we think of the Aruch HaShulchan. That's how we should think of it. And Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein has that last name because of that place. They were from Epstein. And when he was born in 1829, so let's just set the stage for a second, 1829, what's going on in the Jewish people? So Hasidism has already been established. That's a war that might be on its, you know, there's a vestige of that little you know, controversy with the Hasidim, but not much, as we'll see soon. The Enlightenment is in full force, you know, Jews becoming secular all over. But as opposed to other Rabbanim who we've discussed, he doesn't really take up the mantle of fighting for Orthodox Judaism, probably because of the place that he becomes a Rav, there's not as much of a threat, but we'll talk about that soon. He's born in 1829, also uniquely to a wealthy family. Usually when it comes to a rabbi who becomes a rabbi, he's usually poor and destitute and sort of like a rags to riches type of story, riches in terms of intellect. But in this case, he was actually born to a wealthy family, and his family worked for the Tsar. You know, the Tsar that wasn't necessarily the greatest position historically for the Jews. You know, as you know from the beginning of Fiddler on the Roof, what do they say? You have a message for the Tsar. Something like that. And he says, the Tsar should stay far, far away from us. Something like that. A what? A bracha, yes. Right, right, that's what it is. You have a bracha for the czar. And they're like looking at that newspaper and no one can read it except for that one guy that knows how to read. It's that scene at the beginning of the movie. So yeah, may the czar stay far, far away from us. But his father actually was a contractor for the czar's army. I don't exactly know what he did per se, but nonetheless, he was born into this wealthy family. And despite the fact that his father was a contractor, his father, who was not a rav, was a contractor, was very into, was very committed to Kviyas Itim HaTorah. He had always established times throughout his day in order to learn, and that value of Torah was given over to his child, Yechiel Michal, at a young age. And at that young age, as you can imagine, he was notably gifted in the area of Torah learning. But he had established already from a young age that he never wanted to be a rav, at least a rav that took money for his learning. He wanted to be like his father. He wanted to have a decent job and honest living, and be kovei itim just like his father did. It, however, did not turn out like that, because what ultimately happened is because of his youthful scholarship, which by the way he got from his father. He was homeschooled. As a child, he was particularly adept at learning. So his father sent him off to yeshiva. I don't exactly know what the circumstances were, but he sent him off to yeshiva. And where exactly do you send someone for yeshiva in 1837, 1840? Where do you send a guy for yeshiva? Where is there a yeshiva? And where would you send him off to yeshiva? They're living in this little town. I don't even know how to pronounce the town. Somewhere in Russia, Belarus. Where else was there a yeshiva around? What was that, Michael? The Vilna Gaon had passed away in 1798, but the Vilna Gaon left a legacy. He left a legacy which was taken up by Rav Chaim Volozhiner. Rav Chaim Volozhiner starts the Volozhiner Yeshiva in 1801 or whatever it was, some of the beginning of the 19th century. And that sort of becomes the powerhouse of yeshiva, right? And when we think back to the 19th century, which is in many ways sort of the golden age of rabbinic, Judaism, for a number of reasons, either because it's in response to Hasidism and Enlightenment, or because there was a modicum of comfort, or because, the availability of printed Svarim, or because of the Volozhin Yeshiva. Most Rabbanim and community leaders come from Volozhin. Even though it only existed in its full force for probably 95 years, it nonetheless produced many of the rabbinic leadership of the 19th century. And Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein was no exception. He also went to Volozhin, and he also prospered there in scholarship for only 2 years. He wasn't there for a very long time. But nonetheless, he made an impression on a Rav Yaakov Berlin. Does anyone want to guess who was Rav Yaakov Berlin? Does the name ring any bells, Berlin? We've talked about the name Berlin before. It also happens to be the Netziv's father. Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein, gained favor in the eyes of Rav Yaakov Berlin, the father of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Netziv. The Netziv was the most outstanding, ultimate Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin. At the time, however, he was just a student like Rav Yechiel Michal. So this Rav Yaakov Berlin finds this Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein, and as you can imagine, they made a shirch. Rav Yechiel Michal marries his daughter, the Netziv's sister, I believe. And as was the plan, they go into business. They have a textile business. There is this legend that the Netziv was, that Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein was not very good at working, either because he was so focused on his studies or because he just wasn't, good at business. His wife basically ran the business. And apparently at the eulogy for his wife, much later obviously, he he recalled, perhaps in an exaggeration, that he didn't even know where the store was. His wife was so in charge of everything that, and then I saw a different version of it, that there was even a story that one time he was looking for the store and he couldn't find it. I don't know how that's possible, but the one thing that is true is that he was needed for the business because it was established in his name. So anytime there was some kind of official document that needed to be signed or official government agency that came around looking for the business, so he had to be the one to answer to answer all the questions. But nonetheless, that's what the legend is. He didn't really have much to do with the store, either because of his ineptitude or because of his commitment to learning. Now, this was his plan. His plan was that he was going to go into business, and he was going to be Kovei Itzim LaTorah, and he was going to be hopefully successful in learning as much as possible while also supporting his family. As it so happens to be, only his wife was very good at the textile business. He wasn't. So he figured, well, I still have to support my family. And he begrudgingly takes a job as a ref. He never wanted to, as we've talked about before, but he does take the job. This is presumably, you know, when he's a little, he's young. I believe he's probably still in his 20s. And he takes the job as a rav in a place called Navizhikov. Let's say Navizhikov. Obviously, it has a more complicated spelling than an English word, so I can't really tell it to you exactly. But that's how I'm going to say Navizhikov. And what was interesting about Navizhikov, and I saw this in a bunch of places, is it was mostly a Hasidic city. It was mostly Chabad Hasidim. And some Chernobyl Hasidim, apparently. But he grew close to the Tzemach Tzedek, who was, I believe, one of the Rav Menachem Mendel, the Rebbe of Chabad at the time, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe. And he actually gives him smicha, at least I saw that in one place, that the Tzemach Tzedek gave smicha to the Aruch HaShulchan. He had a different smicha, maybe from Velazhin, I don't remember exactly, but very interesting. He got smicha from Chabad. Of all places, I don't think I've ever come across the Aruch HaShulchan making any statements referencing Chabad or the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, maybe, but I don't remember. But nonetheless, he did have an interesting history with them. In this, his first shtela, his first job as a Rav, was in a Chabad town. Legend has it that they had hired him because he was a very refined person. This could have been because of a legend. It could have been because of the Nitziv. The Nitziv was a very worldly person also. If you remember when we talked about the Nitziv, he would be someone who read the newspaper. He read about, you know, he knew a bunch of languages. He was always looking at halacha from a more scholarly or academic point of view. So maybe that's where the refinement comes in. I'm not sure. But nonetheless, or maybe it comes from his father, who was a businessman. They took him as the Rav because of his refinement. His refined personality. That's what they say, at least. Ultimately, in 1863, so 1863, he's 34 years old. Something else happens in 1863 that we spoke about a few weeks ago when we spoke about Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector. Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector had left Nevardik to go become the Rav of Kovna. Now, Nevardik was itself a big city. We talked about that before. But Kovna was one of the biggest, you know. So he goes, he leaves Nevardik and he goes to Kovna. That was Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector. That happens in 1863. And who do they hire? None other than Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein. Later on, the Makor Baruch, which was itself a biography or autobiography in some sort, from Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein's son, Baruch, he writes his biography or autobiography about his whole family. And in it, he records, I think it was in a footnote, if I remember correctly, a correspondence that he once had with a Yitzchak inspector who had left Nevardik to go to Kovna. And he corresponds to the extent where he basically is jealous, envious of Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein. And he says some kind of phrasing like, you know, I wish I could go back to the days of the Nevardik when things were simple and I could learn and I could deal with the Jewish people. If you remember when we talked about Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector, he dealt a lot with policy issues, a lot with tshuva that he had to write, and also with government agencies and political things, Chol VeTzion, if you remember. But nonetheless, the Shemitah controversy, if you remember. So nonetheless, Rav Yitzchak Cohen Spector writes to the Rav Yisrael Michal Epstein, who is now taking over the mantle of his leadership in the Vardic, saying to him, I envy your position, you should enjoy it in good health, etc. There's just one little, incongruency, I should say, that Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein had a certain personality where he was willing to take strong stances, even if it went against the common custom of the town or of the time. So when he gets to the Navardic, apparently, there are a few different stories of this apparently, but one of the major institutions, one of the major customs that he establishes when he gets there is to start early Shabbos. We know early Shabbos will start it hopefully in a few weeks from now after we choose the clocks, and a couple weeks later we'll start davening Shabbos by plag, which is the earliest time you could take Shabbos in. Apparently the reason for this was the people that were working in the fields, or the people that were carrying the water and sort of heavy labor, they had to do as much labor as possible right until the beginning of Shabbos. And those people couldn't start Shabbos with the community. And because the community was starting Shabbos when the sun was going down, so these people were rushing to get home. They were rushing to put their horses back. They were rushing to change their clothes. They were rushing to take in Shabbos. And there was no possible way. If somebody has an emergency need for some kind of thing to be carried to their house before Shabbos, so who's going to carry it? The Jew is going to come carry it, bring it to the house, and then it's the last minute before Shabbos. He's got to still make Shabbos. So he's now got to run home. Who knows how if he can get his horse home? Who knows if he can put his appliances away? Who knows if he can change his clothing? It's already Shabbos. The sun's already down. Right? So Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein says it's not okay. And he basically establishes the minhag, or tries to change the minhag of Navardic, which apparently was a controversial thing. Right? This is Navardic. This is an established Jewish city that he's trying to take on their leadership or the established customs of the place and say, no, we're taking Shabbos in early. So that even when the Jews who are keeping Shabbos need all these workers to bring them their stuff, they still have time to get home before sunset. Even if they have to take Shabbos in later, they'll still have that level of comfort that they have time to get ready for Shabbos on their own. So what does he do to do this? The story goes is that the first week he announces this, he goes to shul, right, to daven early Shabbos, and it's empty. There's nobody there. Nobody listened to him. So he goes around and he takes the young guys, some teenagers, adolescents, and he gets the minyan together, and they daven Mincha, Kohel Shabbos, and Maariv. They go home, they say Kiddush. On his way home, he sees all these Jews, still getting ready for Shabbos, and he goes over, he makes a point to go over to them and say Good Shabbos to all of them, and to make sure that they know that he's starting Shabbos early. And the town gets pretty annoyed by this. And I read somewhere that this happened the next morning, Shabbos morning, but it makes more sense that it happened Friday night. He goes back to the shul at the time when people would be coming for sunset for the davening, and he stands in front of the Aron Kodesh, and he says to everybody there, nobody's davening here in a minyan. I'm the Rav of the shul. I'm the Rav of the city. I say we're davening early Shabbos. If you come later, you're not davening with a minyan. And he prohibits all of them from davening together. They all daven by themselves. And from then on, I don't know if there was more controversy or what happened after that. I don't have much of the story after that. But from then on, Navardic made early Shabbos. He put his foot down and he said, this is what we're doing. We cannot have a society which doesn't treat their water carriers properly. And therefore, we're all going to bring Shabbos in early. And he has, in his Aruch HaShulchan, which is what he ultimately writes, he has a big piece about taking Shabbos in early and the complications that are involved and some things like that. I'm not sure. Sometimes we'll talk about the Aruch HaShulchan soon, but I'm not sure what kind of verbiage he uses there. In general, this was not just a one-time event, but the Aruch HaShulchan generally saw his mission to, in one of two ways. One of them, a little dubious of the source of it, but I'll say the safer position first, which is the Aruch HaShulchan committed himself to to finding kulas, leniencies, for people in his city, for people to live easier Jewish lives. He made that not necessarily his mission to uproot the Shulchan Aruch, but to find legitimate customs with legitimate backing that people could continue doing what they're doing without needing to bend over backwards to take on all these chumras. So this is one of those situations where making early Shabbos. Is it most ideal to make early Shabbos? Are there complications? Yes. But we can be lenient to make early Shabbos if it means making the water carrier more comfortable for Shabbos. And there are other instances of this also, and you can find them in Aruch HaShulchan very often. And this is sort of the other version of it, that very often he's looking at the customs of the Jewish people and justifying them from sources. Meaning, I'll sort of illustrate this by somewhat of a cute story that happened to me. When I lived in at YU, you know, still a single guy, so we would have this thing, me and a few friends of mine would go to the local hospital on Yontif to go, you know, spend time with people who couldn't spend Yontif at their houses. So we went to, you know, just give them a good Yontif and maybe sing some songs, maybe just, you know, ask them how they're doing. And it was in the Erev, and there's nowhere else, nobody else that could do it. So, well, we went over, whatever. And one time we went over, for some reason, they wouldn't let us in the room. So, you know, we went into the lounge area or something. And in the lounge, there were these Satmar Hasidim. So we struck up conversation. We tried to find a song that both of us knew. It didn't really work. But then we got into conversation, and at one point in the conversation, the Satmar Chassid says to me, you know, the difference between us is that you guys are paper a yidin. You're paper a yidin. I said, what do you mean paper a yidin? He says, you keep Judaism based on paper. If you want to know what to do, you open up a book and you look what the book says. We don't base our traditions on paper. We base our traditions on what our father said, on what our grandfather said, or what our great-grandfather said. And there's a certain, you know, quaintness to that. There's a certain intimacy or endearing nature to that. You know, that your Judaism is so much embedded within your family that you don't need a book to tell you how to make kiddush or how to, you know, make brachos, whatever it might be. There's something very endearing about that. There's also something very complicated about that, as you can imagine. You know, anyone who's played broken telephone or the game telephone, you know, it's not so easy to keep things, traditions so straight, which is why you get all these traditions that look a little weird. And if you look back into history, then it's pretty established that these were actually not Jewish menhagim, that they came from somewhere else, and they were co-opted for one reason or another, and then they became Jewish tradition. There are a lot of things like that. So it gets complicated to just based on your father and your grandfather, great-grandfather. However, when you can justify the halakha based on the tradition that you got from your father, your grandfather, your great-grandfather, so then it's a noble cause. And that was the Aruch HaShulchan, at least according to this one version of events, that the Aruch HaShulchan was constantly looking for ways to justify the minhagim that already existed. Things when he would look around town, people were doing this, people were doing that, that might be going against this shita, but there is another shita that could be justified, that could justify that activity. That's another way of saying it. It wasn't that he was necessarily looking for leniency for people, but he was looking to justify what people were already doing. You know, in the aftermath of the Holocaust, a lot of minhagim were lost. You know, my grandfather grew up in a little village called Guxhagen. My wife's grandfather grew up in a village in the Carpathian Mountains called Pilipets. Right? These places all had their own little idiosyncrasies, their own little customs, their own little minhagim. This is how they did it in Pilipets. This is how they did it in Guxhagen. You know, Guxhagen is in Germany, so he's probably just a Yaki. But the point is that after the Holocaust, unfortunately, America became not just a melting pot for secular society immigrants, but also for Jewish immigrants. Right? We tried for a little bit in the early 20th century to create these Landsmann crafts, right, where people from their respective communities would get together and maintain sort of a cultural group, but after a while that was hard to do with your kids going to public school and people moving away to different areas. We lost all minhagim. You know, obviously there are some communities that kept, the Sephardi community, the Yaki community, the Portuguese community. There are different places that have different well-established minhagim that survived those difficult times. But for many of us, we lost many of those minhagim. And therefore, unless you're a chassid, you became a paper yid. You became a yid that said, how am I supposed to keep halacha? Let's open up the Shulchan Aruch, right? But the Aruch HaShulchan, at least in the 19th century, was trying to preserve the customs of the Jewish people. And this, by the way, is also justified or rooted in some Gemaras. There's a famous Gemara in Pesachim where it asks the question, if I remember correctly, what do you do if you didn't bring a knife for the Karban Pesach? Are you allowed to bring it if Erev Yontif, let's say Erev Pesach, is Friday this year? Sorry, no, Erev Pesach is a Shabbos. This year, Erev Pesach is Friday. But if Erev Pesach is Shabbos, which means you have to bring the Karban Pesach in your Shalayim, but you forgot the knife, what are you supposed to do? And you're coming from outside of the area that you're allowed to carry. So how are you supposed to bring the knife? So they asked, I think it was Hillel Hazakin maybe. They said, what should we do? He said, I don't remember. He said, okay, so what should we do now? He says, go on Shabbos, Erev Pesach, and look at what the Jewish people are doing. Im ein neviim heim, if they're not prophets themselves, b'nei neviim heim. They're the children of prophets. If the Jewish people have a custom of doing something, that must be the correct halacha. That's it. So sometimes here also, I say, you know, sometimes I'll look at a situation and I'll say, okay, well, there are sources this way, there are sources that way. Does the shul happen to have a minhag about this? And I'll go to the old timers. I'll go to David Unger and Steve Cohen and whoever else might remember. You know, obviously Manny's not here anymore to sort of tell us how things always run. But you ask the people that know, and they say, yeah, the minhag's like this. Okay, if that's the minhag, so that's how we paskin. You know, that kind of thing. That's few and far between that happens because things are pretty established and I don't really need more clarification. But things like that come up. So the same thing happened. That was apparently the Aruch HaShulchan's mentality to justify the things that people were doing. And he does this in a book called the Aruch HaShulchan. Now, he had already written a sefer. I'm not really sure how much fanfare it got because it was a book on the Sefer HaYasha of Rabbeinu Tam, which is not a very well-learned book. But either way, when he gets to a Nevardic and he settled down basically in the 1890s, he starts writing the Aruch HaShulchan. This is the Aruch HaShulchan. Well, this is only one of many of the books of the Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan was a monumental work. When I say monumental, I mean it's one of a kind. There's no other book like the Aruch HaShulchan. There are books that have similar elements of the Aruch HaShulchan, but none of them that fit exactly. So what is the Aruch HaShulchan? So let's start by saying the different types of codifiers of halacha. You have the Rif, who was essentially one who said, let's take the Gemara, let's strip down all the conversation and just have the conclusions. That's going to be the codified halacha. You can just read this book. It's not as clear as I make it out to be. Oftentimes he'll bring other conversations in. He will quote other opinions, and it's not always clear which way he's passing. Like, then comes the Rambam, who was the most unique, the most monumental of all halachic codifications, which was that he took the whole Gemara and other Midrashim and other Gemaras, the Yerushalmi and things like that, the Midrashim, and he codified all of halacha into the book called the Mishneh Torah, using his own chapter and halachic system, his own pagination system, his own books, right? The 14 books, he just made up the topics himself. So that was probably the most innovative halachic work in history. But after that comes the Torah. The Torah breaks down halacha into four different groups. Not really with chapter and verse like the Rambam, but in his own sort of structured way. Four different groups. You have the Aruch Chaim, you have the Chumash and Mishpat, you have the Eved Ezer, and you have the Yoredeah. But those are just general categories of different types of things. And that's the Torah. The Torah then is succeeded by Rav Yosef Cairo, you know, a little while later, where he takes those four and he makes it into chapter and verse. I don't think the Torah made the Simanim. I believe that Rav Yosef Cairo made the Simanim. But basically he takes there were other people that tried to do this, like the Levush. Maybe the Levush is similar to the Aruch HaShulchan actually. But not exactly. And the Shulchan Aruch basically much more like the Rambam in a chapter and verse type of way, where he breaks down the halacha in very sort of digestible pieces. The Ramah then adds his commentary to it, the Mapa. The Shulchan Aruch means the set table. And the Mapa means the tablecloth. Comes along the Aruch HaShulchan and says, it's been, 300 years of Jewish customs and development post the Shulchan Aruch. We have commentaries. We have super commentaries. We have Shilas Tshuvos responsa, which are clarifying the Shulchan Aruch. We need a new codification. The Aruch HaShulchan is saying this in the 19th century. This is 125 years ago. He's saying that we need a new book. A new book which will clarify the developments and how we should paskin today. Not just in the 16th century, the early 16th century, but in the 19th going into 20th century. And he creates the Aruch HaShulchan. In the Aruch HaShulchan, he has a little bit of an introduction in the beginning of the Choshen Mishpat, for those who have it. And he has, it's obviously linked here, I'm about to quote from. But suffice it to say, these are some of the main points. V'chol machlokas hatanayim, v'ha'amoraim, v'ha'ga'onim, v'ha'poskim, be'emes l'mevin davar la'ashiro, divrei elokim chayim. All of these rabbis, the Tanayim, the Amoraim, the Gaonim, the Poskim, they're all trying to understand everything to the best of their ability, and they are all the words of Hashem. Ulekulam yesh panim b'halacha, and to each one of them there is a worthwhile legitimacy to them. V'adarabba, zoshi tiferes torasenu hakdosha. Not only is it justified, each person's opinion, but it's the cacophony of all of them together, all of the voices coming together, which is the Teferes, which is the splendor of the Torah. V'chol ha-Torah kula nikres shira. And the Torah is called a song. A song, mamish, a song with multiple instruments. Everyone gives their sound. Everyone makes their contribution. V'tiferes ha-shir hi kishakolos mishunim zemizeh. What makes a beautiful song? When you have multiple different sounds. You have the same sound over and over again, so it's not going to make that much of a difference. But a different sound. Zemizeh v'zehu ikar hani'imos. That's what makes it so beautiful. Umi shemeshotet bayam ha-Talmud. Anyone who swims in the sea of the Talmud, right? Yam ha-Talmud, the sea of the Talmud, the sea of the Gemara. Year and ni'imot mishunos. You'll see different types of beautiful pleasantries. V'chol hakolos hamishunos hamizeh. From all of the different voices. You'll pick up a Gemara, and you'll look at Rashi, and you'll look at Tosfos, and you'll look at the Ramban, and you'll look at the Rizva, the Rashba, the Rush, the Rambam, how do you pass on the Shulchan Aruch? And you have all these opinions coming in as like a symphony orchestra, all bringing all these beautiful voices together to make the ultimate sound. It sounds very poetic, and it's very Nitziv-esque, if I will. He has similar types of ideas, but also very Rav Soloveitchik-esque. Soloveitchik has a famous audio recording, which is interesting because he didn't usually like being recorded. But this was at like a Pidyon HaBen, and it's become sort of like the rallying cry for Yeshiva University's rabbinic studies. He paints this whole picture. I don't know if anyone has ever heard Rav Soloveitchik speak, but it's just inspiring to hear him talk. But the way he spoke was so eloquent, and he was so careful of the words that he used, and sort of his rhythm is very. I encourage people to look it up. I believe it's on YouTube, not with a picture, but at least with the words transcribed. It's called the Rav Soloveitchik. I'm sure if you typed in like Rav Soloveitchik Pidyon HaBen, you'd find it. And he talks about how, people ask him, how could this Rav, who's so old, still teach these young guys who can't relate to him and where he comes from? So he says, it's right. When I walk into the classroom, I am old and I am unrelatable to these young guys. But then I start to teach. And when I start to teach, I'm quoting a Tana. I'm quoting an Amora. all of a sudden into the classroom walks the Rashba, and into the classroom walks Rashi, and into the classroom walks Rabbi Yosef Cairo, and all of a sudden I'm no longer the old man in the room, but I'm the young man in the room, and we're all learning from the older generations. And it's just a beautiful vision of sort of the same idea, the symphony orchestra of Judaism and the traditions that come from yesteryear. It's really a beautiful recording. People should listen to it. So the Aruch HaShulchan is saying this in his introduction to his book, which is particularly interesting because the Aruch HaShulchan, and I can go through more of the details, but I'll say it outside. The Aruch HaShulchan approached his work differently than any other, except for maybe the Levush, which never caught on. So it's hard to really for me to appreciate how similar they are. His approach was different. So the Rif just cut away the Gemara that people didn't need to go to all the conversations, and the Rush similarly sort of cut away some of the Gemaras, but quoted the Gemaras, quoted a couple of his contemporaries, and then came out with a Psak. The Rambam cut out all discussion and just the bottom line. The Tor quoted a couple of people, you know, his father, the Rush, and he quoted the Rambam. But in general, he was also pretty straightforward in the conversation. The Aruch HaShulchan mixes together, and the Shulchan Aruch also very, very, after that, very to the point. Maybe quotes the people in parentheses, but doesn't go through the whole discussion. The Aruch HaShulchan, first of all, models his chapters in accordance to the Shulchan Aruch, so that if you're reading the Shulchan Aruch and you're looking at the sort of the footnotes or so the basic, you know, concluding notes, so then you can look at the same number in the Aruch HaShulchan. You pick up the Aruch HaShulchan, and the same, you know, Simon Peches is the same Simon Peches of the Shulchan Aruch. Right? So you can just open it up and look to see what he said. The Aruch HaShulchan is sort of like, you know, the first summarizer, the one who summarizes all the different opinions and all of the different minhagim and all of the different poskim that took all of these rabbis. He took all these rabbis and didn't just distill it into a bottom line, but he rather goes through the conversation. He goes through the different, you know, machlokas. Why did this main opinion and that main opinion disagree because of this? And this is how we paskin. The Levush might have done something like that. The Torah does it a little bit, but obviously doesn't have the whole history that the Aruch HaShulchan had to summarize. So the Aruch HaShulchan also makes it into a chapter and verse. He has his own headings and he's broken up into paragraphs. So you can see here, for instance, you know, this is just random page in Aruch HaShulchan, Simon Ayin Beis of the Choshen Mishpat. You can see these are all different paragraphs, and these can go on for a while because he's summarizing the conversations that are behind the Shulchan Aruch and after the Shulchan Aruch. Right? This is how the Shulchan Aruch says it. This is how Poskim afterwards say it. You know, look at the Magen Avraham over here, the commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. Look at, you know, other, you know, the Taz, whatever, the Bach. So this, for instance, this is still going. This is Ayin Beis. I don't even know what this is about. It's talking about loans. Different, you know, Samech, he's still going here. Right? If you opened up Ayin Beis in the Shulchan Aruch, it would probably be like 25, you know, rules. And he's up to 70 here. It goes up to 72. 72 paragraphs going through the discussion that were ultimately distilled into the Shulchan Aruch, but now he's re-expanding and adding to in the Aruch HaShulchan. This is his whole endeavor in the Aruch HaShulchan, to give people a holistic view of why the halacha is the way that it is, so that people can understand, but also so that people can understand and appreciate that the minhag that other people are exercising is justified because of this. Oftentimes, he'll go through a discussion and say, this is how it's going on here. And this is what it's based on. Not just because, you know, that's what the halacha is, but because that's what people are doing. He has also very interesting, by the way, very interesting pieces in this introduction where he talks about how much he loves the Tsar and Russia and they've been so nice to him, which is particularly interesting because at the end of his life, which is when he writes this really, Russia basically closes down the Volozhin Yeshiva. So it's a little unclear to me whether he's saying this because he knows the Russians are going to see it, which, by the way, they did censor all the Sfarim of the rabbis, and I believe the Aruch HaShulchan, I remember reading this about the Aruch HaShulchan. He had a brother who lived in St. Petersburg, And any time he would go, he would have to go bring his books for, you know, censors, to the censors to make sure that they're all okay. He would actually stay by his brother in St. Petersburg, which is where he had to bring the book anyway. So it's definitely, the Tsar definitely saw this, you know. And presumably they could read it one way or another. I don't know how, maybe the translator or something. But Tsar Khashoggi, I believe, knew Russian, though. He knew the Russian language. So maybe that's how he explained what was going on. I don't know. I don't know exactly what happened, but I know that the Tsar probably saw it, so maybe that's what the introduction is like that. I couldn't tell you for sure. But either way, because of this Aruch HaShulchan, because of his sort of perspective, his approach to halakha, he's seen very differently than other sort of concurrent halakhic decisors. Perhaps the most notable one, the Chai Adam is one, and then the most notable one also in his sort of milieu was the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Shlomo Meir Kagan, Kahan. So he was born around the same time, and he wrote the Mishneh Berurah around the same time. You know, after Shachas, we have the Mishneh Berurah, Chaburah after. So that's the Chafetz Chaim's book, which is only a commentary, by the way. It's only a commentary on one of the sections of the Shulchan Aruch. The Aruch HaShulchan is on all four sections, and we'll get to it in a second. He makes even more than that. The Mishneh Berurah is only on one. Nowadays, there are versions of the Aruch HaShulchan that have the Mishneh Berurah in the footnotes, I think, or the Mishneh Berurah with the Aruch HaShulchan footnotes. I don't remember. Either way, they had very different approaches. The Chafetz Chaim lived in Radin, which was apparently only 75 miles away from the Aruch HaShulchan, but his approach was very different. He took the Shulchan Aruch, and he gave the commentary to it, which went through all the poskim also, but he wasn't coming to justify what people did. He was coming to explain what people should do. Those are very different. Those are very different approaches. He's looking back at the sources and saying, hey, we shouldn't be doing this. The Magen Avraham says like this, we should really do that. We should be machmer like this. The Chafetz Chaim was generally a machmer. The Chafetz Chaim in the Mishneh Berurah usually tells us, if somebody, you know, is, you know, a Baal Nefesh, he should do it like this. The Aruch HaShulchan wasn't like that. The Aruch HaShulchan, perhaps, and this might go into sort of the position of the two. The Chafetz Chaim was the Rav of no shul, no community. He was a Rebbe in a yeshiva, the Chafetz Chaim. Obviously a big yeshiva, obviously a prominent yeshiva, obviously someone who created his own legacy without being a Rav of a shul or a town. But nonetheless, it was still a Rav of a yeshiva. The mentality of being a Rebbe of a yeshiva is one where you can invoke chumras, right? The yeshiva guys, as you probably know, they come home from yeshiva and they've got this stringency that they picked up from their Rebbe. And that's just, and while you're a young, single guy with no family and no job, you can afford to take on chumras. Yeah. You can go the extra mile. It doesn't affect anybody. But all of a sudden, you're going to take on a chumra when you're married to somebody with kids, and your chumra is, you know, being extra scrupulous about cleaning the house before Pesach. So that has much greater ramifications than just you in your dorm room. Now your wife has to follow that, and your kids have to follow that, and you have to clean up after you. There's a lot more sensitivity that goes into a family lifestyle and a shul atmosphere that the Chafetz Chaim didn't really deal with, that the Aruch HaShulchan did. The Aruch HaShulchan, as I said before, had that sensitivity to be concerned about what people are going through. The story goes that one time, actually, on Pesach, he was about to start the Seder, and a woman knocks on his door, and she thought she had traced up a utensil. And from the looks of it, it was definitely traced. I don't know what the situation was, but story goes that the Aruch HaShulchan then, you know, says, give me a minute, and he goes into his study, and he starts pulling books off the shelf, and he's going through all the books. And a lot of time starts to pass, an hour, a couple hours, and one of his children or his grandchildren comes into the room and says, you know, Zadie, you know, Admasai, until when are we going to, you know, we got to start the Seder? So he says, I can't sit down to the Seder if I know that this poor woman, and she was poor, he could tell she was poor, this poor woman wouldn't have a utensil she could use for Yontif. I can't sit at my Seder knowing that she's going to be distraught over not having the proper utensils for her Simchas Yontif, for her enjoyment. And finally, after a couple hours, he was able to find a justification in the sources to say that she'd keep her utensil. It was kosher, she didn't have to worry. So that's the story. That's the Aruch HaShulchan in a nutshell. Finding ways that people can live more comfortable Jewish lives according to halacha, He's not getting rid of any halacha of Chas V'Shalom. And many times the Aruch HaShulchan, he'll see, you have to be machmer like this. But generally, he's looking at the situation around him and tailoring the halacha to what makes people comfortable around him. Because he dealt with people as the rav of a big city for Jews that were living normal lives, who were going to work, who were coming home tired, who had a bunch of kids to deal with. Rav Moshe Feinstein, apparently, when he wrote the Erges Moshe, I don't know if this is printed somewhere where I heard it, he had said, when there's a machlokas between the Aruch HaShulchan and the Chavetz Chaim, Rav Moshe always passed on to Aruch HaShulchan. Because he had that approach, he had that sensitivity to understand what people go through in real life, as opposed to Chavetz Chaim, who dealt mostly with yeshiva bachers, who didn't necessarily have the same complications, and therefore was always going to be a little more machmer. As I said before, he didn't really have much of a political bent. He did, however, support the people of Eretz Yisrael. There was an early settling organization called Rav Meir Bal Hanes. It still exists today. I don't remember that's the literal name. But that was sort of to support the early settlements of Yerushalayim. I think what Rav Shmuel Misalant, I think we talked about him before. So he gave money to them. He wasn't necessarily a Zionist, per se, but he definitely supported the Jews that were living in Eretz Yisrael, so take that for whatever you want. Lastly, the Aruch HaShulchan actually took upon himself to do something even more daring, which is that he wrote this is the most unprecedented thing that he's ever, not unprecedented, but only one of two halachic codifiers to ever do it. He writes what's called the Shulchan Aruch La'asit. Shulchan Aruch La'asid is the Aruch HaShulchan La'asid. It is a codification of law for when the Beis HaMikdash will be built. Only the Rambam ever did such a thing. The Torah, those four categories, the Shulchan Aruch, which is sort of the development of the Torah, you know, the Rambam, the Rush, they don't really have much to say about the Beis HaMikdash. Obviously, they do come up with some things because they're part of the Gemara, but in general, they did not have much of a concern with the halachas of kadshim, whereas Aruch HaShulchan, you know, felt that somebody needs to write a codification so that when Mashiach comes, we're going to need, you know, we know what to do. Obviously, a lot of it is based on the Rambam, if I would assume, but nonetheless, he wrote that, but he didn't actually publish that. He did not actually publish that while he was alive. That was only published like a few decades after he was passed. He passed posthumously, as they say. But that is sort of the lasting legacy of the Aruch HaShulchan, a rav of a city, a people's rav, a real life rav, someone who understood the plight of living day to day, living paycheck to paycheck, living with certain minhagim that had existed already for centuries. And when you look into the Shulchan Aruch, when you look at the Aruch Shulchan, oftentimes he'll find little leniencies, and he will definitely quote, this is what we do here, or this is the prevailing minhag. You know, between Mincha and Maariv, I've talked about a few things that the minhagim that exist. I quoted on Shabbos, his opinion about saying Chazak, Chazak, Vini Chazik, which was not even brought down in any sources to say such a thing. The Ramah says it, right? The Ramah on the Shulchan Aruch says that you should say Chazak to the person who gets an Aliyah. That's every Aliyah. The Aruch HaShulchan is really I can't say this in with 100% certainty, but he's the biggest shoulders who came along and said, this is the minhag. We say Chazak, Chazak, Vi Chazik after we finish a Sefer. Obviously, there are other rabbis that discuss the Eliyah Rabbah discusses in a little bit. So either way, the Aruch HaShulchan came along, this is what we do. This is our minhag. We don't necessarily need, a strong source for this. It's not one of those things that you need strong sources for. So that's the type of posek Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein Halevi was. His son, Baruch, writes the Makor Baruch, which goes through not only some of his personal life, but also some of the life of his family. Just a very interesting biographical note. We mentioned before that the Aruch HaShulchan married the daughter of Rav Yaakov Berlin, the sister of the Netiv. The Aruch HaShulchan, Rav Yechiel Michal, had a daughter, I think her name was Batya, Miriam Batya, something like that. And she got married to a guy who also went into business, But he couldn't hack the Torah learning. She wanted a guy that was committed to learning Torah. And he was only committed to his business. He wasn't willing to really put in the effort, the commitment to learning. Like her father had always taught her, right? You have to be kovei itzim, you have to go to shiurim, you have to learn, you do whatever you can in the times that you don't have to work to support your family. And this guy wasn't doing it. So they actually got divorced within the first year of their marriage over this issue. Later, a little bit later, the netziv, his wife died and was looking for a spouse and married the Aruch HaShulchan's daughter. This daughter was looking for someone who was committed to Torah. So this is like, I don't know if people know the song. There's a song, I don't know who writes it, but there's a song called I'm My Own Grandpa. You know this song? It's actually very relevant for Yevamos, which is starting in a couple of days. But like, you know, you marry your cousin once removed, and whatever, I'm my own grandpa. It's like a whole thing. You can look up the song. It's a very humorous, funny song.
That was from the 50s. I remember that.
Yeah, yeah. It's a funny song. Either way, so the Nativ started as the brother-in-law of the Aruch HaShulchan, ended up becoming the son-in-law of the Aruch HaShulchan. So like, there are a lot of, you know, family connections that just get all doubled in interesting ways. But the Nativ, I believe even though he was much older than her, like 30 years or something like that, they have children. I believe both of the Nativ's prominent children come from that marriage. I talked about this way back when we talked about the Nativ. I believe in the Nativ's children, first Rav Chaim Berlin, who ultimately is the namesake of the big yeshiva in Brooklyn, and then his son Meir, who ultimately changes his last name to Bar Ilan, and is from Berlin, is the namesake of Bar Ilan University in Eretz Yisrael. They both come from this daughter that he remarried, so that Rav Chaim Berlin, or Yeshivas Chaim Berlin, and Bar Ilan University are actually named after the children of the Aruch HaShulchan's daughter, right? His grandsons, basically, were the namesakes of those big institutions, not just from the Nesif. So, and then they're also, you know, weirdly, their grandson, their grandchildren of the Nesif and of the Aruch HaShulchan, even though he was a son-in-law of the Aruch HaShulchan through the daughter, it gets very complicated, as you can imagine. Although there were children of the Nesif, but grandchildren, okay, fine, whatever. Either way, this is the legacy of the Aruch HaShulchan. My impression is that he was in many ways similar to the Nesif, a worldly person who was involved in understanding with a sensitivity to understand other people, and tailored his psak, his monumental work, the Aruch HaShulchan, tailored it to what people were going through in his place. He saw the minhagim, saw the customs, and he was willing to find the sources to justify everything people were doing. So that's the legacy of the Aruch HaShulchan, a fascinating person and a very influential work, which helps us not only navigate, you know, the typical halacha, because it's got all the regular halacha in it, but also in those controversial moments, those controversial customs, where this community did that thing, that community did that thing, he was willing to take a stand and say, this is our custom, this is what we do, we can be lenient for it, and you shouldn't be machmir against it. You don't have to be machmir to say otherwise. You can keep to the halacha as he sees fit. Okay. Fascinating person. Now, from now on, Mirz Hashem, when we hear the words, the Aruch HaShulchan, we'll know who he is, and we will know everything he did for the Jewish people. Okay, everyone should have
Thank you, Rabbi. Wonderful
night. Thank you again to the Big Els for sponsoring the Ili Nishmas. I think it's Avram Shmuel Ben Nachas, Alan Feld, Mirz Hashem, his neshama should have an aliyah.